Okay. Now we move on to an easy topic. Agenda paper 4, prepaid cards. Joan?
Yeah, thank you. In agenda paper 4, we continue our discussion on how to account for the liability for a prepaid card in the issuer's financial statements. At the January meeting, the committee discussed the comments on the tentative agenda decision and asked us to analyze some aspects further. The first is whether the prepaid card arrangement is within the scope of IFRS 9. As described in paragraphs 30 to 32 in this paper and consistent with the previous conclusions of the committee and with most of the respondents to the tentative agenda decision, we think that the prepaid card arrangement is a financial instrument and therefore IFRS 9 should apply to the issuer's liability, which meets the definition of a financial liability. Paragraph 31 in this paper notes our concerns about the potential consequences of concluding that the issuer's liability is a financial liability but is not accounted for as such. Regarding the interaction between IFRS 15, IFRS 9, and other standards, paragraph 42 in this paper summarizes our views. In summary, we think that if the arrangement is within the scope of IFRS 9, it is not within the scope of other standards. We also think that IS 8 is not applicable to this issue. We recommend continuing to exclude customer loyalty programs from the scope of this issue and also recommend narrowing the scope of this issue to the original submission, that is, prepaid cards that are not redeemable with the issuer. Consequently, overall, we recommend finalizing the agenda decision. The proposed wording for which is set out in Appendix A. We'll now hand over to the committee and ask whether you agree with our recommendations.
The questions are, do you agree to finalize the agenda decision as revised? And if so, do you have additional revisions? So comments, questions? Bob, we'll start with you today.
Okay, thanks. As I said at the last few meetings, I still prefer suggesting an amendment similar to what the EITF did. I think they've come up with a reasonable scope, and I do believe that recognizing these liabilities forever just isn't useful to users. But I recognize I was a minority then, and probably a minority could be a minority of one. On the agenda decision that's being proposed, from a technical standpoint, I couldn't object to it. I think the staff did an appropriate analysis. I don't have issues with what it says, but I have issues with what it doesn't say. I think what we're doing if we issued this would be inviting a whole host of additional questions. Because how we're narrowly scoping this, I think we're going to get questions from those who issue cards that can be redeemed at their own stores as well as third parties. Do they analogize to customer loyalty programs, or do they have to look to the basis for conclusion that's in the agenda decision? Because you get two different answers in those cases. I think it goes beyond that. What do people with traveler's checks do? What do they do with casino chips? These are all the same issue. And then we scope out customer loyalty programs, but there's no definition of a customer loyalty program. So I think we're putting a lot of tension on that, and we're going to get a lot of issues of asking, what is a customer loyalty program? For example, there are many programs where I can earn awards, but I can also buy awards for cash. When I buy the award, is that part of the customer loyalty program, or do I have to bifurcate that and track that separately? So I'm still a bit troubled by issuing this agenda decision because I think we're going to be inviting a whole host of additional questions coming in.
But you're not worried about a whole host playing devil's advocate with you. Are you equally worried about a whole host of other questions if we were to do a narrow amendment?
Well, it depends on the amendment. If the amendment is the similar to what the EITF did, I don't think we would get many questions. I think that would be appropriate. I wasn't sure what you're thinking about as an amendment, though. Is it just even narrower than...
No, I think one of the concerns that has been expressed in-house and by some from outside is even if we tried to mirror what the FASB did, we'd be inviting either other questions or expansions of practice in ways that we wouldn't want. So it'd be structuring.
I'm not sure you'd get structuring. You are absolutely expanding. I grant you that. To be honest, after that EITF has been issued, and I recognize it's brand new, but we haven't been getting any questions on scope and how to apply it.
Can I just ask a question, just particularly your comments around customer loyalty programs, because we just have, because, you know, I think your recent experience on the EITF is very useful in thinking about it. And I was just wondering, because I don't think, if I'm right, that there's kind of an official definition of customer loyalty programs in the EITF amendments either, but what it does say is it just says that this guidance does not apply to customer loyalty programs within the scope of other topics, for example, you know, the standard revenue. So do you think even just adding that piece extra to the agenda decision?
No, because we talked about that at EITF, and we did that because so people know, okay, do I go to 606 or do I go to this the EITF? But nevertheless, people aren't going to get it wrong because either way you go, it's the same guidance. It's the same issue. Whereas the problem here is if I go to IFRS 15, it's a very different answer than this agenda decision.
All right. Moving this way, Carl.
I'm comfortable where we are, and I support this agenda decision. My only last concern is about the scope out, the redeemable in the own store, to scoping only 30 part merchants. I'm not sure about this. Okay. The logic behind this scope up. I'm not sure about this.
Charlotte?
I don't think Bob is in a minority of one. I agree with him totally. I think if we do this, it needs to go down the amendment route. I'm concerned that you narrow, this is a really narrow scope agenda decision, and it still leaves you with a question about what you do with things that don't fall under this definition. I mean, for example, if something is a loyalty program but can create a financial liability, that seems to say you end up in a very different place from any other financial liabilities, which to me is a contradiction. And I think that sort of clash between the revenue recognition guidance and the financial instrument guidance is the thing that we're sort of stepping around, really, rather than dealing with it head on. And my question is, I don't know what firms who are using the guidance now, what would they do if they don't fall into the guidance in here? Will they continue to be the diversity in treatment that some of them are treating them as financial liabilities, or some are treating them under the revenue guidance, or would this sort of lead them to go down a different path? I don't know where it leads us, if it actually helps the situation at all.
Bruce?
Thanks, Wayne. To start off with, I mean, I agree with your agenda decision because I think on the question that we've been asked, I think it's the right answer, and I don't think there's any debate on that. I guess the only concern I have, and maybe it's just being expressed by quite a few people, is if we start talking about permutations, we're going to be here all week. You know, I mean, we can start going into every little permutation that this resolves, which means if we think this is a big issue that needs to be addressed, well, then it needs to be kicked up and we need to look at an amendment to the standard. It needs to open up the derecognition. And I don't think there's a quick way around that. I really don't think there's a quick fix to this, because I think that when we start unpacking everything, as we have in our discussions, this is a big project. I don't think there's a quick fix to it. On the other side of that, I think that issuing it in this format says, look, we've asked a question, we've given an answer to that question. And I think that for the people who submitted it, we need to answer the question that was asked. So I think it is very difficult. I mean, my suggestion would be, I think the agenda decision is correct and should be issued as it is. I think as far as the, I don't like the answer. I mean, I agree. I think it's silly that we've got these things considered on balance sheet in perpetuity. I think it's a silly answer. But then I think that should be kicked up to the board, and we should be saying, guys, we think there's a fundamental problem with it, and it should be addressed at that level.
Yeah, I would, if Sue were here, I think she would say, there was a reason why 39 was written the way it was. And that was in part to prohibit what some of you want to do. It was put there to say you don't get to pretend that liabilities go away unless they go away contractually. And so I understand that in this circumstance people, and I don't get to vote, so, but I understand that you all feel that this is an unusual accounting, and I agree in this circumstance it is. But in defense of 39 and 9, because Sue isn't here, there was a reason, and it, to an extent it was abuse prevention, that it was written the way it was.
And that's what I'm saying, if we kick it up to the board, and the board turns around, and that's the collective view, that that's what 39 and 9 say, and we're not going to change it, well then I think we've issued the right to general decision, and that's the answer.
Okay. Point taken. Bonnie?
I agree with Bob, primarily because I don't know how it's useful information for some amount of liabilities to stay on the balance sheet for forever, particularly if an entity has information about breakage of cards or awards or whatever that will never be exercised because people lose them, don't use them, for whatever reason. So I do agree with the staff conclusion that it is a financial liability. I do agree that if that's the conclusion, it points you into IS 39, IFRS 9, and what the guidance in there says, I think it's quite clear. I just struggle to see how that's useful information for a user of the financials to know that there's a liability that's going to stay there for forever. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Would you, devil's advocate time, if I came to you and I said, I'm a bank, and I have the same statistical information about customer deposits, would you take the same view?
I think it's a different product. I think the facts and circumstances are different. So I would be an advocate of the EITF approach, which is a very narrow scope. To pull it out. To me, that's a different animal, and it should be treated differently.
Okay.
That's my view.
Andrew?
Well, as this issue has moved forward and I've heard more views and learned more about some similar fact patterns, I have become more sympathetic to the suggestion of a narrow scope or a not-so-narrow scope amendment to the financial instrument standards, but on balance, that isn't my preferred course of action, partly because I think of the question you touch on, Wayne, where do we actually draw the line? It's not just unclaimed credits and, or dormant bank accounts in the banking sector. I've had similar questions in things like unclaimed credits in the utilities sector, and the gaming industry, customer accounts. So I struggle to see a rationale for producing a narrow scope amendment that just focuses on stored value products without addressing some of these broader credits where the same, relevance challenge, reflection of the economics challenge can be raised. I mean, back on this specific fact pattern, I've consistently agreed that this is a financial liability, and I guess I support moving forward to finalise the agenda decision. I guess what we're trying to do is a somewhat is define the scope of the issue somewhat surgically, and then say nothing, and to some extent leave it to judgment around whether other arrangements with some similarities are accounted for consistently with this decision, or whether they're accounted for consistently with the revenue guidance. And that judgment exists because there's a mutual scope out between IFRS 9 and IFRS 15. In the interest of being perhaps even more precise in the issue we are providing guidance on, I'd prefer to say not only it's a subparagraph C, it says redeemable for goods and services. I think in the fact pattern it's redeemable for goods or services to a stated monetary amount. So this prepaid card is expressed and always expressed in terms of a monetary amount, not expressed in terms of an entitlement to specified goods or services. So I would like to narrow it down further.
That's a topic. I think that's a very good suggestion, at least in the context of what we were trying to do internally yesterday as we discussed this. Okay, let's keep going directionally. Yongsoo?
I just want to first say that, you know, I agree with this staff analysis. I think this is the financial instrument and convinced by the analysis of that. I'm appreciative of that. But I also have a concern about the breakage. I concur with the Bob and Bonnie that the breakage is going to be built up and it's going to stay in the financial statement forever, which is not going to be paid in the future. That doesn't represent the reality of the substance. And also the breakage is going to be increasing. I mean, it's going to be piling up so that, you know, as time passes, the liability is going to go up. It doesn't represent the real, you know, the substance of the prepaid card. So that if we think about the, you know, the faithful representation, not recognizing the liability, I mean, not recognizing the breakage is against the faithful representation. That's the first point I want to say. And the other one is that, you know, the more I think about this case, the more I think that, you know, breakage is also considered by the designer or issuer of the prepaid card when they design the card. When they set the price or provide the price of the card, they already think about how much breakage is going to be occurred in the future. Otherwise, they cannot, you know, the design the card at all or price the card at all. So that, you know, if it is designed in that way, then the financial statement must represent what the designers are thought about those prepaid cards. So again, I want to go back to the faithful representation. If we want to put what the card is designed or what's going to be the results of the future, the financial statement must recognize breakage. So you know, my point is that, you know, I understand what Wayne said, you know, IA39 or IFRS 9 is originally a very different perspective. But we have to think about whether breach is not going to be allowed just because that is not written in the contract, because it's a financial contract. That is what we have to think. From now on, I think we are accustomed to the IAS 9 and IFRS 9. So we have a good understanding about that. So now we have to proceed to the next level, I think, what we have to do. Or some kind of reality, some can give us some diverge from what's written in the standard.
So you would propose a much broader amendment.
So yeah, let me propose two things. The first one, you know, for this project, this is the IFRS Interpretations Committee project, which doesn't have to spend too much time or resources. So I the first one I want to propose is this is a financial instrument and don't say anything about other things about breakage. The second proposal might be the same as the US GAAP. You know, we can say there could be some kind of exceptions about the breakage, even if it's a financial liability, and it's going to be a narrow scope exception.
Oh, okay. That's what I...
Or the third one is that, you know, still we can recommend to the board, you know, we have to think about that kind of issues.
Okay. Reinhard?
This, I think, is a discussion at this table and at other meetings has demonstrated is a very difficult topic, difficult discussion. And I think, you know, when I look at the fact pattern as described in this paper, I would agree with the technical analysis that the staff has concluded. I think, though, entities in this business looking at this, what feels uncomfortable about that approach is the fact that I think, as others have articulated, they see themselves primarily in the business of facilitating, being an intermediary and facilitating trade between a customer and a merchant, and which is in their minds arguably different from a bank, where you're directly dealing with a customer, you're talking about a deposit liability. And so when you're facilitating transactions, it just seems like the revenue guidance would be more a logical way to look. Having said that, as I say, unfortunately, we have the wording in IS 39, and so I agree with where we are. And so when I look at it, I do think what may happen along the lines of what others have suggested, people will look at this agenda decision, and in practice, there are features, many features that they have that are different from this, and they will look to accounting for it perhaps in a different way and say this is a very narrow scope agenda decision for that specific fact pattern. My facts are different, and therefore I need to think about how to apply judgment to my facts and circumstances. So, as I say, I think it's unfortunate that we are where we are, which is the very, very, as you said, Wayne, the anti-abusive criteria in IS 39, and this fits in there because it just doesn't feel right, as others have said, where the entity really is just, they're not directly lending money to somebody. They're just facilitating transactions with others. And that sounds like, as Jiang Xu said, from their perspective, that's a source of breakage, is a major source of the income that they have, and that's the way they think about it. So having said that, I'm not sure an amendment to IFRS 9 is really the way to proceed because, again, it's a scoping issue. And so I guess what I'm saying along about way is agree with the agenda decision. I do think, though, that people will try to distinguish their fact pattern from this to come up with another answer.
Okay, let's go with Martin, Pablo. John, you haven't had a chance to come in yet, so that's my top three, and then I'm going to go to the phones. Tony, you have your on the list, too. Martin?
Okay, I guess we narrowed it down to the absolute minimum with regard to what you could do. And technically, I guess I would not object. However, I believe it might be useless. We might get many other questions. And paragraph 42 illustrates in a wonderful way what is the way of thinking, what are the steps, and when you are in which accounting standard. However, for every step here, different measurement attitudes apply. And the question really is, what is the economic background? And I would suggest to do a two-way approach to
finalize the agenda decision. But on the other hand, ask the board whether we could go for a more holistic approach and try to find a broader solution for the overall economic background of vacatures and so on. Probably narrow scope, yes. But if there are business models based on that, we should consider an accounting solution for it.
I do believe that Jiang Xu has hit one of the fundamental concerns, though, is a limited carve-out, people are going to say, why not me? And that's always the problem with limited carve-outs. It's not just this one. Pablo, banker's view.
Banking regulator's view.
Banking regulator. They're different. And then we go to the phones for Sandy and Fei Long.
No, precisely. I think it's a really interesting topic, and after discussing with some of my peers in the banking regulation area, most of them agree. As long as the fact pattern relates to a financial instrument, so as long as this transaction is considered a financial instrument, it should not be treated differently. This is, I think, the general opinion in the banking regulation field. It should not be treated differently to a demand deposit. So as you said before, you may assimilate this to a situation, or you may assimilate this breakage, this issue with breakage, to the stickiness in demand deposits. So if you had, theoretically, if you had statistical information available that allowed you to determine which or what that stickiness might be, theoretically you might incorporate that into the measurement of demand deposits. It's not something that's avoided in the measurement of like, for instance, when there's a merger or an acquisition of a bank by another bank. This stickiness is considered. So, in fact, breakage, if there was a substantial amount of transactions of this type. Breakage theoretically would also be considered in the valuation of the acquired bank, but that doesn't mean that has to go into the measurement of the demand deposit or into the measurement of this kind of liability. I agree there might be a point, as Reinhardt said, in saying, okay, this is not an intermediation-based activity, but rather the facilitating payment transactions. However, demand deposits are also, in a way, more akin to the processing of payments than to the financial credit intermediation per se, and and that doesn't avoid or that doesn't guarantee or justify their measurement or the measurement of that stickiness. So, in a way, I think this is a very similar topic to demand deposits.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the phones, and then, Philippe, I'll come back to you. Sandy?
I guess I've been waiting a while to say that I agree with Bob about a narrow scope, but I understand all the challenges associated with doing it. I mean, I guess over time, these businesses can adjust their business model to add termination dates, but you know they have existing cards or contracts or boxes or whatever you want to call them that are going to result in amounts hung up on their balance sheet forever, and you know those are this cash that's never dividendable to users of to the owners of the company that's stuck up in that liability. So I don't know how to, on a going forward basis, I think entities can adjust, but I don't know what they do with the existing liabilities that they have, or if there's any capacity to sort of do this prospectively. I don't know. I mean, I agree with the staff paper. I agree that in theory you shouldn't be able to recognize them. I just have great empathy for the fact that these liabilities are hung up there forever, and it's cash that's going to be stuck in the enterprise and never be able to be distributed in the form of profits and dividends to the owners of the company.
Okay. Fei Long? Okay, we've lost Fei Long. Charlotte, you've had a turn already. Philippe, you're up.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Martin, maybe some others who suggest that the board might take care of this issue, which route we should follow in your mind? Because there are two ways, either to scope this kind of transactions out of IFRS 9 or do a specific limited exception as EITF did, which in itself doesn't have a very strong conceptual basis, or to modify IFRS 13 and say this kind of liability can be fair valued, taking into account breakage, and the specific exception that we did for demand deposits when we did fair value measurements, and we did that at the request of the banking regulators, if I remember correctly, to say, oh, bank deposits cannot be put on the balance sheet at less than face value, but it was a kind of an exception to the principle of fair value measurement. So what kind of solution should we try to work on?
Martin, did you want to come back on that?
Considering a limited exception like the EITF, which should at least be discussed whether this might be an appropriate solution for these specific types of arrangements. And in addition, one could also consider convergence in that regard.
Political minefield, I know.
All right, just a moment. I've had a request for camera controls. What is it I'm supposed to
keep
do here?
You're view. Supposed to keep it on full view, I think.
I didn't think.
Just when it was getting interesting.
Yeah. I think it is on full view. No.
Is it linked to the mic, so when you call the microphone up, is that?
Yeah, but. Okay. Comes from being a grandfather. All of a sudden, I'm a technological illiterate, it seems. Martin, would you repeat what you just said? Because I lost it in the back and forth.
Yeah, okay. I said, well, I was thinking about this limited exception, like which is more or less like the EIGF.
No, I won't do that.
I anticipated this.
Can we take, everybody just wait for about as long as this takes?
No, because we all have them.
Okay. If I make sure whenever I look up to push wide one, I'll be okay?
In terms of the board view, yes.
Okay.
But in terms of when they speak, we'll have to go to the mics and switch them on individually. They don't come in. We didn't get the mics and the sound.
Oh, well, that's because I forgot to turn it on. But that's okay. Now, Mark.
Yeah, my view, and I guess this would be in line with the expectations of our constituents, is that at least one should consider to do this, say, narrow scope issue like the EITF, and the board should spend some time to discuss whether is it worse to have such it would be a kind of, well, a mixture of interpretation, narrow scope, change, don't know what. It would then probably be in line with convergence. However, as I said, I know that in many other areas we are not convergent anymore, but at least we could learn from each other and could discuss it. And it might be that for good reasons, one could not come to that conclusion. But on the other hand, at least our constituent would have seen that there was a discussion and there was a debate on this issue, because I believe this is an important issue and we will get more questions with regard to that topics. Because, as already said, the conclusion we are drawing now seems to be very, very narrow.
Okay. John, Tony, and then back to Charlotte.
I agree with the technical analysis. I'm also not a fan of considering a narrow carve-out for certain types of products, because where do you stop? What's the difference between a stored value card and a demand deposit in reality? And I'm sure there are myriads of other things within the spectrum between them, such as traveler's checks and gift cards and all sorts of different types of products. So I don't think creating different accounting requirements for different products that have the same underlying fundamentals is actually a good basis for development of standards. So I wouldn't be in favor of sort of creating narrow exceptions for product types as has been done by the EITF. I do think there may be a broader issue that should be looked at, which is the derecognition requirements for financial liabilities. But I mean, that's obviously a very broad and very significant type of project. And I think, and maybe there is validity in looking at that in the context of the broader issue, but I wouldn't be in favor of creating some sort of narrow class of products and looking at whether they should have special requirements for derecognition. I think the TAF technical analysis is correct. I do have some concerns with how narrow it's been scoped, because it does suggest that the things that are outside the scope, the financial liability guidance doesn't apply. So in other words, if I have a card that's redeemable at merchants but might also be redeemable at the issuer, is that no longer a financial liability, even though the holder has the option of where they redeem it? That seems a bit strange conclusion to me. I would have thought that they should be included, because there's no control or discretion for the issuer to avoid paying cash, and therefore they would be financial liabilities in the same way that the ones that are redeemable only at merchants are financial liabilities.
Okay. Tony, you hadn't come in, and then back to Charlotte.
So obviously I've been pushing on this issue for a while, so it may come as a surprise to know that I would definitely not support an amendment to, or suggesting an amendment to IFRS 9, IFRS 13. I think for the reasons that John's just described and others, I just think that narrow scope amendments are fraught with difficulties because of the way you have to, they effectively become a rule and it needs to be very, very tightly drafted. And so I wouldn't support that. I understand why we have the guidance we have for demand deposits and some other things. And so I would not support a narrow scope amendment. My concern throughout the debates that we've had has been potentially the agenda decision being applied more widely in areas where I think it conflicts with other aspects of the guidance. So I think if you were to apply to a custom loyalty program today, the guidance would conflict with what IFRS 13 says about accounting for loyalty points that can be cashed in with third party. And so that's been my concern throughout, that we end up with something that's potentially inconsistent with the revenue guidance. And so I think my sense is when the nature of the transaction is to provide a facilitation service or in connection with the customer loyalty program, I think the revenue guidance makes more sense. And so I don't disagree with the staff's analysis in here. My sense would be to go ahead with this, but to scope it very narrowly. So I agree with the changes to be explicit it wouldn't apply to customer loyalty plans, to be explicit that it wouldn't apply to cards that could be cashed in with the issuer. And I would maybe borrow some words from what the EITF, the FASB used around stored value cards of a fixed monetary amount or something like that, or maybe the words that Andrew suggested.
Yeah, I think that's whatever.
So that we end up narrowing it to something that looks really very, very much like a demand deposit or a traveler's check. And so I will be comfortable with going ahead on that basis.
Okay. John?
No, I was at my last sale.
Charlotte and then Bob.
I just had 2 points. I think like the fundamental problem I have, it feels to me like customer loyalty schemes are effectively a narrow scope amendment already. And they're a narrow scope amendment because it doesn't feel like it follows the criteria in paragraph 42. And I think if you took a customer loyalty program and ran it through paragraph 42, in a lot of cases you would end up with it being financial liability and you should account for it as that, which I think is where the gap is. So where we end up with this amendment is, or this tentative agenda decision, is having people either trying to analogise to that amendment, the customer loyalty scheme. And I think that just feels wrong to me because I think that one is the one that is, I hate to say, it's not in accordance with the rest of GAP. Now, my problem with that is I actually think it's in accordance with the economic reality. And that is the concern, is by going down the line of being in accordance with GAP, you move away from economic reality. But fundamentally, I mean, although people laugh, I think that was the problem with IFRS 9 and IFRS 13 in respect to some of the banking products. I don't think you're measuring deposits and you're ignoring the fact some of them are not going to be redeemed at par. I think it's more of an IFRS 13 issue, which forces you to use an artificial value for fair value. It's also a construct to do with the unit of account, because any individual deposit, I put it any individual gift card, any individual loyalty program, your fair value would be par, would be the amount it's valued at. It's when looked at as a class, as a portfolio, that you sort of need to bring into account breakage or the sort of the intangible in the context of deposits. But fundamentally, without that, you've got a non-economic answer. And I've seen the problem in reality when you're doing acquisitions of deposits, acquisitions of firms with traveller's checks, that the value that you're putting on it economically is not the value you can put on it in your financial accounts. And the accounts just do not reflect GAAP, or do not reflect, do not reflect the economics or reality. And that just seems to be wrong. And it seems to me we're just not facing that head on. But in this context, I just feel that I don't know how you can put in that line about ruling out customer loyalty and have that paragraph 42 and saying this is the approach, because to me that's the fundamental conflict.
Okay. Bob?
I thank you. I agree with Charlotte. I think
the board has already potentially opened the door. We have a narrow amendment on customer loyalty programs, unless you come back and tell me that customer loyalty programs are only scoped to those where they're only redeemable for the issuer's goods or services, which that's not how that's being applied today. So if we look at how it's applied today, we've already opened the door. And so now we've got this issue, well, are these prepaid stored value cards and similar instruments more similar to the customer loyalty programs or demand deposits? I don't see them like demand deposits. Demand deposits, well, first of all, demand deposits in many jurisdictions are subject to escheat laws. So those liabilities go away eventually. The way the EITF looked at it, because they did not want this to apply to demand deposits, bearer bonds, all kinds of other debt, is they added a principle in this that says it: these are instruments that are issued for the purpose of being accepted as payment for goods or services. So the idea is the customer, the holder of the card, is not trying to get cash out of it. It's trying to get the goods or services. It's similar in concept to what the arguments Tony was using as to why these aren't financial instruments. Now, I do think it's a financial instrument, but it's not there for the purpose of earning a return on cash and getting cash back. It is for the issuer, or if not the issuer, the cardholder, in order to get a better service.
Okay. I think we're starting to retread or revisit or re-argue things, so I think that means it's time to try and call the question. I've heard 2.5, maybe 3 proposals. One is that we should ask the board to fundamentally rethink the conclusions that were made in 13 and 9 about liabilities that have a demand feature. I haven't heard from any of the board members, but I suspect that would be a long uphill slog to fundamentally amend 9 and 13. I'm seeing board members nodding their heads. Philippe?
We are due to undertake a post-implementation review of IFRS 13 to start relatively short term. 13, okay. Post-implementation review. So there is an opportunity, at least on that one, to maybe think about the issue as part of 13, as part of measurement. To reopen IFRS 9 in the short term, probably not. But IFRS 13, I think there is an opportunity.
Okay, point taken. How many favor the agenda decision as written, except for Andrew's amendment, which is to state that they are in part C redeemable for goods and services to a stated monetary amount? So with that amendment, how many support the agenda decision?
Eight.
And on the phone? Sandy?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, Sandy supports. Fei Long, are you back with us?
Yes, I come back. I support.
Okay, then that's the decision. We go forward with it as is. I think some of the concerns that I have been raised to several of us may be alleviated with Andrew's amendment. I'm not sure, but I think that may address part of their problem. Okay.